Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Richard Haass has worked at the top levels of American foreign policy under two Bushes, and it's pretty clear which he prefers. Haass is a foreign policy heavyweight who is defiantly a conservative, not a neoconservative. Now he sees a giant opportunity for America that may be slipping away. Tonight on Point, conservative foreign policy guru Richard Haass on hope, opportunity, and the risk of a new dark ages. But first, we begin tonight in Washington with reaction to President Bush's nomination today of California Congressman Christopher Cox as chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. William Donaldson resigned as chairman yesterday. Here is the president today on why he chose Cox.
Chris understands how markets work, and he knows the need for transparency in financial exchanges and in the halls of business. He proved that he can bring people together of diverse opinions to get things done.
Christopher Cox has favored cutting taxes and limiting shareholder lawsuits. He's known as a friend of business, which may be just what the White House wants at the SEC, after several years of crackdown from the commission and New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer. Amy Boris covers the SEC for Business Week magazine and joins me now. Amy, what's the signal that you read in the Christopher Cox nomination?
Well, it would be a mistake to think he'll be a pushover for business, but it's no surprise that the business community is ecstatic over this nomination, and with good reason. He is likely to move the SEC more toward, you know, into more business-friendly approach to rulemaking, maybe less so toward enforcement, but certainly in rulemaking. And you just pointed out a couple of the reasons why. If you look at his past, his achievements to date, I mean, he is best known in financial circles for spearheading landmark legislation that makes it harder for shareholders to bring security fraud lawsuits.
Amy, it was only a couple of years ago when the whole country was up in arms about Enron and all the other meltdowns, WorldCom and the rest, and there was a powerful sense, President Bush articulated it, that it was time to tighten up around business. Does the Cox era or the appointment nomination here indicate that it's now a reversal of gears, that the president thinks it's time to loosen up again?
Well, that's probably the subtle message. I mean, that was then, this is now, and the pendulum is swinging. It seems that business, you know, is no longer in a defensive crouch over corporate crime. Memories are fading, and there's a widespread perception in business circles that the SEC and other regulators and the Sarbanes-Oxley corporate reform law that was passed in 2002 went too far.
So is the United States likely to find itself back in the circumstances that allowed those scandals to develop and unfold?
Well, that would be going too far. Certainly there the Sarbanes-Oxley law is on the books, and the SEC has passed a number of rules that there's no reason to believe that Mr. Cox would undo necessarily, but we probably passed the high water mark for reforms and reform rules at the SEC, and you're probably likely to see more deregulatory moves and a much more moderation in rulemaking at the SEC. I think Christopher Cox is known as a very meticulous, detail-oriented guy, a pragmatic conservative who will want to see the evidence that a proposed rule is really sensible and will really make a difference before he pushes it through. The other side of the coin, though, is enforcement, and there he has to be very careful because no SEC chief likes to be seen as weak on enforcement, and certainly none can right now with Elliot Spitzer out there ready to criticize the SEC if it is perceived as weak, and other state regulators only too happy to do that as well.
And Amy, what about William Donaldson as he prepares to ride off into the sunset here? He said yesterday in announcing that he would resign that he wasn't going because of criticism or resistance to his regulatory efforts. Are people buying that?
I think there's reason to take him at his word. This is a man who, repeatedly, despite being warned and admonished by Republican leaders on Capitol Hill, we don't like what you're doing. He did it anyway. He did what he felt was right time and again. He is a personal friend of the Bush family. He did what he thought he should do and went forward. People close to him say that there were maybe personal reasons for him wanting to leave now. He has a wife and son who live in New York. He's been commuting, and those bring strains. So I wouldn't think he was strongly pushed at all.
And Amy, finally, for ordinary American investors, not corporate titans tonight, but ordinary investors who may have been badly burned not so many years ago, if you're talking about a high watermark of oversight regulation being passed here already, should people feel comfortable that the uprightness of markets is going to be vigorously policed under this new SEC chairman, or is it back to an age of uncertainty?
Well, Christopher Cox is a securities lawyer himself, so there is no reason to suspect that it's going to be open season for business or go in any way. But sure, when the business climate is such that there's a big push for the SEC to do less rather than more, investors should be a little wary.
Buyer beware. Amy, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Amy Boris covers the SEC for Business Week magazine. She spoke with me from Washington. The White House, State Department, and Pentagon have their hands full. There's a war in Iraq and a war on terror, instability in Afghanistan, nuclear ambitions in Iran and North Korea, and a rising China and India. Now, a big conservative voice is questioning the fundamental direction of U.S. foreign policy. The George W. Bush administration says Bush 1 and 2 veteran Richard Haass has sunk enough time, money, and resources into an expensive war of choice in Iraq. Its crusading foreign policy risks alienating the world. Instead, he says, the United States should be integrating the major powers into a new concert of nations in multilateral cooperation. Sounds like the new world order again. This hour on Point, Richard Haass on a global moment of vast opportunity and risk for America. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you size up the gains and losses of Bush 2 foreign policy? Do you see the moment of opportunity that Richard Haass describes to remake the world? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He directed policy planning at the State Department during George W. Bush's first term, was a top Middle East advisor to Bush Sr. and aide to Colin Powell. He's also served as U.S. coordinator for Afghanistan and envoy to the peace process in Northern Ireland. His new book is The Opportunity, America's Moment to Alter History's Course. Richard Haass, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, hello. Good to have you on.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Mr. Haass.
Richard Haass, the book is titled The Opportunity, straight out of the gate. What is it, The Opportunity?
The opportunity for the United States, working with the other major powers of the world in this time, India, China, Europe, Japan, Russia, that rather than focus their energies on competing or going to war with one another, which has been history's pattern, that instead there's an opportunity now for them to essentially join forces to become partners in dealing with the real challenges of this era, which again are not one another, but are rather the products of globalization, the spread of nuclear weapons, modern terror, global climate change, infectious disease such as HIV/AIDS, trade protectionism, essentially products of this modern world we live in.
You describe a kind of unique moment in history, or at least rare, when the big powers' interests more or less line up. They don't need to go to war. They could work together, as you see it, and work toward a better future.
That's exactly right. I think there is this opportunity. In part for the reason you just mentioned, that there's such a gap. There's not a balance of power in today's world. There's an imbalance of power. So the idea of going to war to thwart or somehow stop the United States is simply not an attractive option for anybody. But also there's very little reason for them to do so, even if they could. A lot of the things I've just mentioned, a lot of American goals in the world, to stop the nuclear spread, to stop terrorism, to stop genocide, to promote free trade, these are not somehow selfishly or narrowly American goals. These are goals which others ought to be able to subscribe to. And again, I think this breeds a real opportunity.
But you're very pointed in saying that the current administration is not taking full advantage of this opportunity. Why not? What's up with the direction of foreign policy that's not leading it to capitalize?
Well, my concern is that, in fact, as you suggest, we are squandering the opportunity. It's not lost yet, but I'm uneasy that 15 years after the end of the Cold War, we haven't done much to make the opportunity a reality. In part, it is because the United States, by at times what it's doing, at times how it's doing it, is unnecessarily alienating important pieces of the world, important countries around the world. And just as important, what it is we're doing is eroding the foundations of American strength, which are responsible for this opportunity in the first place. And by that I mean by overstretching our military. A big chunk of it is tied down now in Iraq, by running an enormous fiscal deficit, an enormous trade or current account deficit, by increasing rather than decreasing our energy dependence on imported oil, by the gradual decline in America's competitiveness. So my concern is that this really remarkable opportunity, when you think about it, is slipping through our fingers.
Jack Beatty, that's a pretty tall charge from the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, from a man who's worked deep inside Bush 1 and Bush 2. That's a big alarm bell being hit.
It is, but, you know, when he was just describing that picture of politics among nations suddenly suspended, or the age-old struggle among nations suspended precisely because of this unipolarity in the world today, I thought I had the first feeling of optimism I felt in years. That is the opportunity. But you see, the Cold War worked two ways. We were containing the Soviet Union, and we were also contained by it. That is to say, our crusading impulses had to be measured, and we couldn't afford the adventures. We couldn't afford to do everything that's desirable. We had to stick with what was possible.
Jack Beatty, Richard Haass, please stand by. We're talking tonight with a conservative Bush 1 veteran who's blowing the whistle on Bush 2 foreign policy. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. Do you see the opportunity? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with a former aide to Colin Powell, who says the Bush 2 White House is squandering a historic window of opportunity for a real new world order. Our guest is Richard Haass. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was director of policy planning at the State Department from 2001 to 2003, served in high places under Bush 1 as well. He's author of the new book, The Opportunity, America's Moment to Alter History's Course. Jack Beatty's with us as well. You can join us. Do you see the moment of opportunity Richard Haass describes to remake the world? Did you glimpse a new world order under Bush 1? Does a new concert of nations seem to you feasible, desirable, or dangerous, delusional? And are we posed, as Richard Haass suggests, between a kind of new world order and a new dark ages? Which way are we leaning? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Richard Haass, the book is called Opportunity, and really you describe it as a time-limited opportunity, a window of opportunity, and you describe the stakes in quite stark terms. You say it's between this sort of new concert of nations is one possibility. On the other hand, a new dark ages. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are actually three possible futures. One is the one we'd obviously like to see, where this opportunity does become reality and there is a good degree of security in the world and stability, of political freedom, of improved standards of living. One alternative to this is the possibility that the United States, the dominant great power of this era, finds itself locked in a new Cold War with China, the rising power of the 21st century. That's one possible future, and that could be dangerous because cold wars are dangerous, and obviously it's expensive, and it would be a distraction because all the energies the United States and China would pour into competing with one another would be resources they wouldn't have available for tackling global problems. The third future is the one you alluded to, the so-called Dark Ages, and this is one where simply the United States and others would be to some extent overwhelmed by everything from the spread of nuclear weapons. Just imagine not just North Korea and Iran end up with nuclear weapons, but then their neighbors do. Terrorists get a hold of it. We then see 9/11s done not with, simply with airplanes, but with chemical or biological or nuclear material. We see HIV/AIDS spreading, as it already has, way beyond Africa, and we see major problems in societies such as Russia and India and even China. We see global climate change gain pace. So one can lay out a scenario of these kinds of global problems, regional problems, no progress, say, between Israel and the Palestinians on top of it, problems like Darfur, of genocide becoming more numerous. So one can, if one doesn't have to work very hard, if you want to be pessimistic enough, you can find a rather worrisome or even frightening future.
Richard Haass, you began there by saying the future we'd obviously like to see is this one of kind of integration, of problem solving. But who's the we here? The New York Times describes you as an internal exile, along with a lot of other of Colin Powell's folks, really on the outside looking in, nose pressed against the glass, as a conservative, the old sort of realist school. You've been very critical of the neoconservative crew that's had a lot of sway in George W. Bush's administration. Is there really a we? Who's the we who wants to see this more integrated future? And what's the future that you see President Bush's administration pushing toward?
Well, I believe the ideas I'm suggesting in this book do have an awful lot of appeal. I would think in part they're appealing to large elements of this administration because there are elements of this administration which reflect this thinking. Just to make it clear, this is not an anti-Bush administration tract. This book was essentially completed before the election, and I didn't know if I would be writing for the first Kerry administration or the second George W. Bush administration. And if you look, for example, at what they've done in the area of counterterrorism over the last 3 years, that is a very good example of what I'm talking about. The United States, working with many of the world's governments and countries, has made the world a more difficult place for terrorists to succeed. Or if you look at what we do in the area of trade, under the international trade agreements, under the World Trade Organization, the WTO. This is a very integrated world, which essentially contributes to our well-being and to the prosperity of others. What I'm suggesting is that these ideas can and should be extended in other areas. I think there's potential receptivity in the administration, certainly in the Congress, but also around the world. So I am hopeful that these ideas will gain some traction. Look, it's 15 years after the end of the Cold War, and it's 15 years after the doctrine of containment that served us so well has essentially been made irrelevant by the end of the Cold War and the demise of the Soviet Union. We need a new compass for American foreign policy, one that makes sense for this era of history, and I've put forth integration as that compass. I believe it's attractive to Americans, it's attractive to others, and I'm hoping that people come to see it that way.
But what do you mean exactly by integration? We've seen a lot of resistance with this administration to multilateral constraints, let's say, treaties pushed away, an attitude toward the United Nations that everyone's seen, the neoconservative sort of persuasion. Well, I mean, you're at the Council on Foreign Relations now, not the National Security Council. You are on the outside looking in. You're not driving this boat.
Sure, but ideas matter. This society is affected every day by ideas, whether you're looking at the Social Security debate or the debate over stem cell research or the debate over American foreign policy. These debates, if you unpack them, at their core, you will find ideas. So, there's a marketplace in this country, and essentially what I've done is try to introduce this idea of integration. What is it? On one hand, it's to get the United States to essentially bring in the others, the Chinas and the rest, so they see more reason to work with us than to work against us. Secondly, it is to tie up the world in the way, say, we've done it against terrorists or in trade. Well, why can't we take that same principle? Why can't we make the world a much tighter place against the spread of nuclear weapons? Or why can't we set new rules in the world so if a government commits genocide or allows it to take place, there then is an international response? And thirdly, why shouldn't we integrate the poor people of the world and the people who don't enjoy any freedom? Why should we have billions of people around the world trying to subsist on less than $2 a day? They're not participating in the world economy. Their countries are potentially fertile soil for terrorists. So this is something, again, that I would think would be attractive, by the way, to this administration, which, among other things, has increased American foreign aid dramatically and has increased American aid to try to combat HIV/AIDS. But, so I don't think these ideas are necessarily hostile.
But the integration you describe, as you put it there, sounds a lot like sort of world government view of the future that we know there have been powerful voices against in this administration and powerful arguments made against.
There's nothing about this that's world government. What I'm talking about is American leadership. But leadership requires followership. We have got to take the lead in essentially getting other governments to voluntarily work with us on combating common problems. I'm not talking about a super UN. I'm not talking about a super anything. I'm talking about nations, including our own, operating in their own self-interest. And the fact is that the nature of these problems, which have the potential to overwhelm us all, can only be met by common effort. This is not kumbaya multilateralism. This is hard-headed stuff. But we will be overwhelmed by nuclear proliferation or terrorism or disease if we don't essentially find a way to get others to work with us. We can't solve, take the most pressing issue of the day, which is North Korea's nuclear program. We will not be successful at solving that unilaterally. We need, more than anything else, China's active involvement. The same goes for trying to deal, say, with Iran. It's simply the nature of the problems requires a collective response, and reality is that the limits to our own resources also requires that others partner with us.
Jack Beatty, I don't doubt Richard Haass's sincerity for a moment here, except maybe when it comes to the point of the Bush administration being strongly in support of this. This kind of collective action would seem to be the theme that's been a kind of anathema very often with this administration.
Well, certainly with the misadventure in Iraq, I mean, and the long-standing view on the right that alliance systems are constraints, that the U.S. will gets lost in the collective will. You know, I think what Mr. Haass was just describing really was Kerryism. This is what John Kerry was saying in the campaign, basically. He was talking about multilateralism and international. It all sounds great. It all sounds great. But until realists actually step up to their theory and turn to the crusaders, turn to Mr. Bush and say, Mr. Bush, you know, it would be great if we could change, create democracy in the Middle East by force, but we can't. And the effort to do it will only drain our treasure. We have been able to live with all kinds of regimes in this world whose systems we find anathema. And we can continue to do that. And if we find they have weapons of mass destruction, we can deal with that. But we cannot set out to save the world or to eliminate a transnational problem like terrorism. We're going to create democracies everywhere in the Middle East, forgetting the change in international affairs comes from the perennial forces of history, not from the impositions of nations.
There's a view. Let's get a call. Marion's calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Marion. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. What's on your mind, Marion? What do you think?
The ideas that just have been expressed by this gentleman
yes.
are so preposterous, so terrible, so frightening, and are absurd.
Why? Why?
I come from Soviet Union, ex-Soviet Union,
yes.
as a child, Second World War victim, and have gone through a lot of terrible fights and lives, and here in America at last. And what Father Bush has been saying, promoting, he was mistaken and misled, and I think I hope he awakens from that dream, and his son now is doing a much more better. He believes that.
Marion, let me ask you, what's wrong with nations working together collectively? Do you believe that works or not?
They are working together collectively since the United Nations was established. but working together collectively, like Russia, imperialistic country, there's always competition, there's always domineering nation, there's always somebody that wants to be in charge, but for whose purpose? For his own, and not for the rest of the humanity. They are not angels. Human beings have a lot of on the plate of good and evil in their character.
Marion, we've got it. Let us work with that right there. Richard Haas, how about it? You appeal to the kind of better angels of national nature to work together. Marion says it's not the way it works.
Well, Marion was expressing what is essentially the classic realist paradigm, that competition and the pursuit of power and advantage is inevitable. And the sort of stuff that I'm talking about is unrealistic at best, naive at worst. I would simply say that we have reached one of those, potentially reached one of those transition points in history, and it's because of two things. It is because of enormous American power, which doesn't make it tempting for any other power to challenge us. And secondly, it's because of the nature of the world today. We live in a fundamentally changed world because of globalization, and because, as a result, the principal challenges of this era are not what countries do to one another. Rather, it is the impact of these forces, the spread of nuclear weapons, terrorism, protectionism, disease, global climate change, what have you. We have entered a different period of history, and the challenge is really an intellectual one and a political one, which is whether we recognize it and then adapt or adjust our foreign policy to it. Again, this is hard-headed stuff, and I don't want you or any other listener to think that this is somehow soft. This will only happen if the United States leads. It will require all of our resources, including military resources, but not limited to military resources.
Richard Haas, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation, a critical voice, I'm expecting. Lawrence Kaplan joins us. He's senior editor at The New Republic. He writes about foreign policy for Commentary, The Wall Street Journal, The Weekly Standard, The Washington Post. He's former executive editor of The National Interest. Lawrence Kaplan, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So Richard Haas says we've got a great opportunity here. It's a window, and we may be missing it. Nations need to get integrated and integrate quickly. Are you on board with this view, Lawrence Kaplan?
Yeah, I'm on board. There's not much to object to when one's proposing closer cooperation between nations. My principal objection would be to what Mr. Haas is omitting from his prescription, namely the character of regimes, which I think this administration's been very forceful in pointing out. The character of regimes, rather than merely relations between regimes, is really what matters at the end of the day. And I guess I was interested to hear there's really nary a mention of democracy in the litany that Mr. Haas was enunciating, and I think that's important. I think as a level of analysis, the internal composition of regimes, I think, especially since 9/11, American foreign policy has really begun to realize that really that matters as much as the structure of relationships between regimes. Mm. And specifically, I think the Bush administration has made a very strong case that democracy, in particular promoting democracy, is not only a moral, but essentially a very important strategic interest.
But does it really work? Richard Haas had an essay in the Washington Post in January, headlined, "Freedom is not a doctrine. Promoting democracy is the wrong priority for foreign policy."
Well, I frankly disagree. The fact is, the more democratic the world becomes, the more congenial it becomes to the United States. Democracies, as a rule of thumb, rarely, if ever, wage war against one another. And more germane to the post 9/11 era is repressive regimes tend to breed terrorists. That's an empirical fact. And the logic of the Bush doctrine, I think, is the more democratic the Middle East becomes, the less likely it is to generate terrorists through either repression. Or otherwise, that really what we need is a much more liberal Middle East.
Let me interject just for a moment, Richard Haas. Are you ignoring the character of regimes? Is that a fly in your soup?
No, I believe that U.S. foreign policy needs to take into account the character of regimes. The argument that mature democracies tend to make better citizens and better neighbors and don't wage war against one another tends to be true. The argument that what happens inside other countries is not simply a moral or humanitarian concern, but is also a strategic concern, is something I also endorse. I think there was the realization after 9/11 that the domestic policy, say, of Saudi Arabia is a foreign policy matter for us. Indeed, if I'm not mistaken, I gave the first public statement reflecting that of anybody in the administration. Mm. My position on this, though, is that while promotion of democracy needs to remain a dimension of American foreign policy, we don't have the luxury of making it the principal doctrine of American foreign policy. There are simply too many other concerns that at times need to take precedent. For example, we need now to garner, say, Chinese or Russian cooperation to deal with nuclear proliferation. I wouldn't want us to in any way forego that simply because we're frustrated by the lack of democracy in either country. Plus, we also need a little bit of humility here. Promoting democracy is tough. It takes time. You often never quite get to where you want to be. And as a result, again, I don't think we want to base American foreign policy on it. Mm.
Lawrence Kaplan, in a word, a little more American humility, a good idea or not?
No, I don't think so. I think, if anything, perhaps a little more self-confidence. I think if you, for instance, look at the democratic revolutions of recent months, whether in Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, or Lebanon,
or right there in the Middle East, maybe that's the evidence of success. Lawrence Kaplan, thank you very much for joining us tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with a conservative Bush 1 veteran who's blowing the whistle on Bush 2 foreign policy. Richard Haass is with us. He's president of the Council on Foreign Relations, author of The Opportunity, America's Moment to Alter History's Course. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Is Richard Haass got it right, or is the world more dangerous and less manageable than he suggests? Is he all wet, or is he a prophet, a wise realist? And what does it mean that Richard Haass and Colin Powell are now on the outside looking in? Have Americans given up on deep global cooperation? Have you? And what does that mean for the future? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mo is calling from Edison, New Jersey. Hi, Mo. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Yeah, I have a question. If you look at this Iraq war over the course of 10 years, which is 3 or 4 years we've been into this war, and the next 5 or 6 years, as is predicted, this war is going to cost about $1 trillion, give or take, based on $80 to $100 billion a year cost going forward. And if you look at the population of Iraq, which is 25 billion, it works out to about $250,000 a head.
You're saying $250,000 ahead of whom? Of Americans? Of Iraqis?
Iraqis per capita.
The cost of a war over that time. Okay.
If you spend $1 trillion on this war to control 25 million people, that works out to about $250,000.
That is an expensive project. Mo, your line's breaking up on us, but I think we've got the nut of that. Richard Haass, this speaks to a point that you raise very pointedly about the sort of cost-benefit analysis of the Iraq war. Give us your analysis here.
When I do the cost-benefit analysis, and one has to obviously point out that it's still a process underway, but when I did it before the war started and when I do it now, I conclude that the benefits are outweighed by the costs. And obviously one of the benefits is that we've gotten rid of Saddam Hussein and his regime. But the costs have been and promised to be enormous. You've got the human cost in American lives. More than 1,600 have been lost. You've got probably now more than 12 or 13,000 U.S. casualties. You've got the hundreds of billions of dollars of financial cost. You've got the wearing down of the American military. Recruitment's beginning to drop off. You have the fact that we're pretty well tapped out militarily, so we don't have the available military forces to influence other situations the way we'd like. We've clearly used up an awful lot of goodwill in the region and the world. And so, while again, I welcome the fact that Saddam is gone, anyone had to have been impressed by the Iraqi vote. And it's also possible that what happens in Iraq, and it's a tremendous if things do improve somewhat, it could have a positive impact on the region. But I simply don't think the costs the benefits justify the enormous costs. And I believe directly and indirectly, this conflict in part is contributing to the shrinking of the opportunity that I've been writing about.
And you say that this was your view in the run-up to the war as well. Did you express this view to the White House in the run-up to war in Iraq, and what was the response?
I did make this view known, though it wasn't easy given the way decisions were made. I essentially was in the minority, obviously, as the way history played out, that after 9/11, the idea of going to war clearly gathered pace. And it was clear to me by the summer of 2002, roughly 9 months after 9/11, that the administration had essentially decided on a course of action that would most likely lead to this conflict. So people such as myself, who had doubts about it, didn't really have much of a chance to influence whether we went to war. Instead, we had to pretty much confine ourselves to questions of how we did it. For example, did we go to the UN? Did we go to the Congress? And so forth.
Let me ask you, though, if you can, you must have thought a lot about this. Take us to the core of the difference in worldview that led the administration to the opposite conclusion from your own. What's at the heart of that fork in the road?
It's a great question. I'm a little bit hard-pressed, not because I don't want to answer your question, but I don't quite understand it. I think, though, people thought that it was necessary to go to war for some simply because they believed that Saddam possessed weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological weapons, and that he had clearly violated the will of the international community by ignoring more than a dozen UN resolutions.
Yeah.
For some, that was enough. I think for others, though, they saw this as, to use the word in a different sense, an opportunity to score a decisive geopolitical victory. That they thought that by ousting Saddam and turning Iraq, as they thought they could easily do, into a thriving democracy, that they could send a very rough message to the Iranians and North Koreans and others and essentially make tremendous progress across the range of American foreign policy. They really thought that this was going to be one of those decisive acts of history that was going to change the course of history.
By a display of force, has that worked?
Oh, clearly not. That, again, the display of force in the war was impressive, but the aftermath has so absorbed U.S. resources that I actually think it's reduced U.S. leverage against, say, Iran and North Korea. And obviously, while things have not gone sufficiently good or well or smoothly in Iraq, where it's become a model for anywhere else. So I don't think this has become a decisive event in the positive sense. What worries me, and I truly hope and pray that I'm wrong, is that I hope this does not, by so weakening the basis of American power and perhaps raising doubts in the minds of the American people about the wisdom of an acting world role, which again really worries me, that you could have a kind of Iraq syndrome if this turns out to be an extraordinarily expensive engagement, that this could actually contribute to history moving in the wrong direction rather than the right direction.
That Americans would really want to come home and say, forget the rest of the world, or try to say that.
Which would be a dangerous tack, to say the least, in an age of globalization where simply you can't hide from the world.
John's calling from New York City. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I really feel I need to offer some ideas in a slightly different direction.
Let's hear it.
Whenever our president talks about those dirty people out there who hate freedom, I cringe.
Why?
Because he is sounding like a 12-year-old boy from the 1950s. I'm a 62-year-old man. I'm a former naval officer. I lived through the Cold War. I followed all of this. I'm a Vietnam veteran. He sounds like a McCarthy-era Republican, is the best way to put it. The problem is not only with all those people who hate freedom. They don't hate freedom, I don't think. Yeah, perhaps they have a lot of different ideas, but we're trying to shove down our idea of democracy. And what I see democracy from the Bush administration meaning is a world full of Walmarts, sports shopping, consumption, dumbing down. And I think what we need in America is to get our spiritual life in order. And when I'm talking about spiritual, I don't mean evangelical Christian. I mean our spiritual life as to what's important in life.
So, John, we've got that. That's the kind of inner house in order. But when Richard Haass talks about pushing for greater global integration and the United States leading the way on that, what does that mean to you? Does it sound workable, feasible?
I'm afraid of a world in the image of America today. You know, the Eastern European regimes that fell when the Iron Curtain fell were terrible. They were horrible. But it was a very sad thing, because the idea behind it was a noble idea.
Going all the way back to the socialist dream there. John, our time is short, so I'm gonna leave it there, but we thank you for your call. Very thoughtful. Richard Haass, here's our caller, John, thoughtful man, military veteran, he says, is afraid of a world constructed in the image of America today. What do you say to that?
I think he raises a thoughtful point that we've got to have some humility. We can't think of foreign policy as a giant cookie cutter or a template where we impose our system or exactly our approach on anyone else. It's going to ultimately have to be homegrown and tailored for local conditions. But that said, I don't think there's anything wrong with an active U.S. role in the world where we stand up and we support, say, the right of girls to get an education and to be literate, or where we help governments deal with HIV/AIDS, or where we say people ought to have basic freedoms of assembly and religion and speech, or where people ought to have the chance to have a higher standard of living. I don't think there's any reason to shrink from that on a human level, on a moral level, but also on an economic and strategic level. A world that where people do have more freedom, where people do have a higher standard of living, is likely to be a world where we are more successful at taking on challenges that range from terrorism to genocide. So if there's a danger in us doing too much, there's also a danger in us doing too little. And like a lot of things in life, the foreign policy challenge, to some extent, is to come up with the Goldilocks solution.
And can you explain how this would work? I mean, lots of people look at the UN and say, noble idea, ineffectual. There's so much tension around treaties. People, you know, we have treaties, and people say people don't actually observe them. When you talk about integration, what's the practical way in which you imagine this unfolding that would really be workable, that would be effective?
What would matter is that the United States and the other major powers of the day, again, China, Russia, Japan, Europe, India, and also others such as Brazil, say, and South Africa, that they essentially agreed that it was in their own self-interest to sign on to a set of rules, maybe build some new international institutions, maybe simply adapt existing ones, and they would promote this collective idea, for example, that countries shouldn't be able to gain control of a nuclear fuel cycle, or that no one should be able to commit genocide against its own people. And that when they saw governments violating some of these basic principles or supporting terrorism, that they would act. It could be sanctions. It could even be military force. That essentially you would have agreement among the major actors on what the fundamental rules of life had to be, given the fact that in a global modern world, we simply can't insulate ourselves from what happens elsewhere. We simply don't have that luxury anymore.
Jack Beatty, we've just got a minute here, but that's not exactly one nation, one vote. That's big powers getting around, laying down a scheme of rules. Richard Haass says the opportunity is now, and it won't last.
Yes, it's one of those plastic moments, you could say, when the affairs of nations are changing. But, you know, to return to what Mr. Kaplan was raising, he was talking about democracy. Well, of course, as the Defense Science Advisory Board pointed out, that's not a meaningful concept to the people in the Muslim world that we're trying to influence. For one thing, they see us as hypocrites about it. For another, the language they want to hear about is justice, something very different. And rather, far from hating our freedom, at least according to the Defense Science Board, they hate our policies. It's what we do in the world.
The Iraqis seem to like their voting, Jack. Lebanon's looking forward to a vote here.
Well, let them have their vote, but, you know, I'm very skeptical about democracy in Iraq if it means a Shiite hegemony.
And there, maybe on the other side of that, Richard Haass would see an integrated concert of nations. Is it the New World Order? Is it Bush 1 New World Order, Richard Haass?
Well, Bush New World Order was never fleshed out, and what I'm trying to do is come up with a set of ideas that I think make sense for the post-Cold War world, if you will, 11-9, when the wall came down, and the post-9-11 world.
Well, here it is. With that, we're out of time. Richard Haass's new book is The Opportunity, America's Moment to Alter History's Course. Mr. Haass, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks very much for having me.
Jack, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
In a moment, On Point contributor Sue Diaz talks about a tragedy that struck close to her home. This is On Point. Tragedy struck the San Diego neighborhood of On Point contributor Sue Diaz recently when a 15-year-old girl tried to kill herself with a handgun. The incident left Sue shaken and led her to reflect on how intertwined all of our lives really are.
We never heard the shot fired inside the house two doors up the street from ours. It was Saturday afternoon, and while my husband and I were in the dining room enjoying a leisurely lunch with two old friends in town for the weekend, our neighbor's 15-year-old daughter lay in their front flower bed, bleeding from a bullet aimed at her heart. "Help me," she whispered. Todd, who lives next door to us on the other side, was the one who heard her, but he nearly didn't. He and his two children had been out in their front yard playing soccer. Todd had just dashed across the street to retrieve an errant ball. If it hadn't bounced where it had, he never would have heard the words she uttered, never would have seen her stagger into the front yard. When he did, his jaw dropped. He yelled to his kids and anyone else who might hear, "Call 911, now!" "Who did this to you?" he asked the girl, kneeling at her side, his eyes darting toward the house, the bushes, and up and down the street. "I did," she told him. The next day, in an email from a neighbor across the street, I learned some of the details of what had happened, along with the girl's first name. I'll call her Sarah. I still don't know her last name, and have no idea how long she and her parents have lived in that two-story house with its three-car garage and flower-bed geraniums. Unlike most of the homes in this upscale suburb, that one's been a rental for several years, and my contact with its various tenants has typically been limited to glimpses of them at the mailbox. That Saturday morning, Sarah had a soccer game. Her parents had been there, cheering from the sidelines. With another game scheduled later in the afternoon, Sarah's mom and dad planned to spend part of that in-between time at the fitness center they belonged to. Sarah said she'd bring a book to read in the car, but that's not the way things played out. While her mom and dad exercised, Sarah, who didn't have her driver's license yet, snatched up the car keys and drove herself home. There she hunted for the handgun she'd once overheard her parents say was hidden in the rafters. After she'd knocked off its safety lock with a hammer, Sarah sat down in an easy chair in the family room, angled the gun toward her chest, and pulled the trigger. After that, she managed somehow to make her way out the front door and into the yard. Whether it was regret that moved her or reflex, only Sarah knows. A later email update said that Sarah was in the hospital, on a ventilator and in a drug-induced coma. That neighbor's message ended with, "The family could really use our prayers right now." The reason Sarah did what she did can only be guessed at by people like me who didn't know her, but more desperately by those who thought they did. Even as someone on the periphery of this tragedy, I can't help but replay the events of that afternoon and think about the bonds I believe all of us under this same sun share. Our lives are connected, whether we realize it or not, in ways none of us will ever completely understand. Most likely Sarah never imagined that some woman two doors down would continue to hear her whispered, "Help me," long after the ambulance that carried her disappeared around the corner. In feeling that way, I'm sure I'm not alone. And I hope with all my heart that Sarah's eyes will open soon to know and accept that neither is she.
Sue Diaz is a writer and a regular contributor to On Point. She lives in San Diego. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.